Blog Talk Radio.
...of KJMA's practice of constructive community reporting, we have invited Dr. Khalid Mohammed, Minister and Supreme Captain of Minister Louis Farrakhan and the elite fruit of Islam, to help us to put today's events into perspective. Dr. Mohammed.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. The Honorable Elijah Mohammed and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan teach us that no matter how bad the condition looks that the black man and black woman is in, no matter how much self-destruction, no matter how much destructive behavior and conduct we see on the part of the black man and black woman, no matter how low the black man and black woman has fallen, the black man is the original man, God's people.
Could you help us to understand the kind of forces that create a Frank Williams?
When we look at a Roberta, a Frank Williams, and the many Frank Williams across the nation of America and the black nation in general, when we look at a Frank Williams, we see one who is other than self. And when we see him doing evil, we see him doing evil which is learned behavior, learned and picked up from the very devil himself over the past 400 years. I guess, Roberta, we could say the devil made him do it.
They say the revolution won't be televised. I guess that's why the world turned and paused and moaned when Tupac and Malcolm died. All my bloods and thugs and Harlem Nights. Keep reading, keep writing, keep fighting for our queens. Queens, moves, pawns, trading kings, lie for temporary cars and charms. I'm the son of Nat Turner, the godson of Nikki Giovanni, nephew of Asada Shakur, second son of Afeni Shakur. So you know the pride of the Panthers in me. Marcus Garvey's red, black, and green is in me. Fools getting shot down, locked up for material living. This is all genocide. Let's get free or die trying to save our nation and children. Let's get free or die trying to save our nation and children. Let's get free or die trying to save our nation and children.
Black power, black power, and more black power to my people. It's your brother, soldier in arms and comrade in battle, Sean Saddam Kweli, and I'm happy to be able to broadcast live once again to you from right here in the hills and smells of North America. And man, if you were just with us in the first half of Black Power Radio, I know that your mind is still sizzling, your mind is still cracking, your mind is still bubbling from Dr. Dennis Kimbrough and what he laid down on us on that economic basis and studying the black millionaires and all that he gave us. We got to get into another aspect of the struggle, though. First of all, let me say that if you're joining us for the first time here, or if you're a second or third time listening with us now, that we open this up saying we bear witness regardless to land, label, or language. It's only one God, and that we recognize that God in the masculine and feminine expression. And we are thankful to our people who were the original mothers and fathers, the original people, the original government on the planet, those original teachers, and those original architects of everything that we know and that we stand on today. We're thankful to them. We're thankful to all of our freedom fighters who came, whatever period that they came, and giving us that example. We are thankful for those greats who helped us to begin in 1989 and rebuild this work, this Panther work, out of Dallas, Texas. We're thankful to the Honorable Dr. Khalid Mohammed for taking the reins as National Chairman. And that when he made his physical transition, we're thankful to the attorney at war and the man who I call the attorney general, Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz, for taking it over and building on the structure and expanding the base. And we're thankful today for our national chairman, that man who I just got off of the phone with, and he sends you black power greetings to the radio listening audience as he's crisscrossing the country right now. A free man, let me say that loud and clear, a free man is... Many of you all know he had come under a lot of pressure, a lot of heat, spent some time in the jails of white America, because he had put out and helped to organize that reward for George Zimmerman after Attorney Malik Zilu-Shabazz combed them law pages down there in Florida and found out that when a crime had been committed and the state wouldn't act, that it was lawful to organize that citizen's arrest. And so our national chairman, Mr. Hashim Nzinga, made that announcement on CNN next day. You know how it go. They're knocking on that door. But he's a free man. He's on no paper, no probation, no nothing. And you know, I know the enemy is shaking in your boots tonight, knowing that our national chairman, Minister Hashim Nzinga, crisscrossing and moving, organizing and shaking, putting the pieces together so that we can organize to do for self and have self-determination. So we're honored to be with you tonight. We say black power. We greet you with peace. Assalamu alaikum. Hotep. Shalom, shalom. We say free the land. We say abargani. We say hotep. Or as the general say, what's up? Whatever language you speak, peace to you. Welcome, Black Power Radio, Monday night. We into the second quarter, 10:30 on your Eastern hour. We're here with you as we're going into Black Robes and White Justice. Black Robes, White Justice. We have a special guest on with us tonight, a brother who really, really, you must know, as he is involved with a lot of moves down there in Alabama, but one that I really want to spend time on, introduce to the community and introduce to you, is Operation Clean Slate, which is something that he helped to organize and put together, I think about a year ago, and he's interested in turning people around, you know, and stopping that revolving door that we see so many times within what we call the criminal just us system, that revolving door, and stopping many of our people from making the same mistakes over and over again, or as they say, the same mistakes and expecting a different result. We're going to talk to that great honorable Chief Magistrate Maurice Muhammad as he's on with us, and we'll bring in our national spokeswoman, who you all must know is doing a wonderful job in representing the new Black Panther Party for self-defense, and she must become the premier voice for black nationalism, black power, revolutionary Pan-Africanism, revolutionary nationalism here in the hells and smells of North America. That black woman who is fighting in that spirit of the great Honorable Sister Safia Bakari and others. And so I want to bring in my co-host here, National Spokeswoman Sister Nadia Asada Shakur. Black Power, you there with me?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm here, Black Power.
All right, Black Power, Black Power, Black Power. All right, so we got Nadia on deck. So now the only thing to do is to bring in that black man who's moving and shaking down in Birmingham, Alabama, and doing his thing, making sure that we don't see him on the bench unless it's by revolutionary means. Brothers and sisters, you all help me to welcome to Black Power Radio our brother, friend, and comrade, Brother Honorable Maurice Muhammad. Black Power. Assalamu alaikum. You with it?
Black Power. Wa alaikum salam. How
Black
are
Power,
you, dear
sir.
Brother?
How are you,
great.
My sister?
I'm blessed, my brother. I'm blessed.
Praise Allah. Praise Allah.
Listen, Allah.
Doing great. Brother Muhammad, welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you for being on with us. And I know we got a lot of, and I know it's a lot that's on your mind, but do us that favor of first introducing yourself and letting us know who you are for those who may not be familiar, or as I say, may have been living underneath a rock, but let them know who you are. Who is that Magistrate Maurice Muhammad?
Well, brothers and sisters, I am honored to be with you today. On behalf of the Nation of Islam, I'm a member of the Nation of Islam, love the Nation of Islam, and love our people. Love what you're doing by educating and bringing light to our people, and you're doing it with our sister, and our community needs to see the black woman and the black man working hand to hand for a result. And I'm honored to be with you and your organization. I think that this is what time it is that we all get together. But I'm Brother Maurice Muhammad, born and raised here in Birmingham, Alabama, And for 17 years, I was a magistrate in the city of Birmingham. And just about a year and a half to almost 2 years ago, the city of Bessemer brought me in as the chief magistrate in that city and gave me an opportunity to just really set some records straight. You know, our communities, both Birmingham and Bessemer, are predominantly black. Both of them have over 70% of the population being black. And so we are working so that our people who are in the system can see a couple of their faces, our friendly faces. And what we're doing is just trying to make a hard road a little bit easier, because we know that, you know, the belly of the beast is no joke, and we know this system is no laughing matter. I was graduated from Miles Law School here in Birmingham, in Fairfield, Alabama. I'm a graduate of Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, and just kind of been all over the world. I played a little basketball over in Copenhagen, Denmark, came back, did my thing on the college level, and did my thing around the way playing a little basketball, but decided I wanted to study the science and the skill of law, and went into law school. And didn't have a stellar academic background, but I had a desire and a love for my people, and I thought that this would be the best place to help our people inside of the law, because they tell us that America is not a land of, is not a country of men, but a country of laws. So if we don't understand the laws, and if we can't interpret those laws for ourselves, then we just become a group of men's men. So I just wanted to do my little part and do what God has given me and given what God has blessed me to do by just sharing myself with the legal community and coming in and just doing a work.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that introduction. We want to get right into it, Brother Muhammad, because we don't want to waste time. This is a serious, serious topic. We're talking about the mass incarceration of our people. And I know this is something that you see every day on a daily basis. And I know one thing for sure. I noticed, of course, this has been in the Muhammad Speaks program since the earliest days. It's in the final call.
Yes, sir.
The back of the final call, it's in the new Black Panther 10-point program as well. We're talking about wanting freedom for our brothers and sisters that are locked down in the jails, locked down, you know, in the international jails, military jails, the city jail. We want our people free, and black men and women free from the prison industrial complex. But I want you, as a chief magistrate and a man who has been behind the bench and you see it from the inside, kind of tell us, what are some of the factors that's causing our people to end up in these court situations like we are?
Well, brother, what I have seen in my nearly 20 years experience in this is I see a community that is suffering. Of course, we see the obvious signs. We see poverty. We see the lack of education, proper education. We see the lack of positive and proper job preparation. But one of the biggest things, and probably one of the most misnomering things that we see, is depression. Most of our crimes are committed from a standpoint, from what I see on just a misdemeanor level. Most of our people are just trying to relieve that pressure. They're just trying to relieve a little depression, and we don't know how quite to do it. And so we get involved, you know, a lot of our domestic relations. I see domestic violence. I was a domestic violence specialist for 13 years. And when I talked to the people, it was just, it wasn't money. It was just, we just depressed and didn't know what to do, so we just turned in on each other. And it's like, wow, when you look at us, you go, wow, we are really a depressed people, from the standpoint that we are not living to a potential or living up to the potential that we set for ourselves. You know, most of our young people have big dreams and they have big aspirations, but at a certain point, something happens. And what we're trying to do now is kind of locate that certain point, you know, sometimes in young men, we see that certain point happening as they begin to enter middle school. Sometimes we see that certain point in our young women after they graduated. You know, so it's case study. It's deeper than we really want to look at because there are so many factors involved. Of course, the very obvious ones, poverty. You know, we're coming from split family homes. We're coming from bad social situations. All of that is a contributing factor in what we see today as the great macrocosm. We have a lot of small microcosms that we are not we're not working with and we're not working through, so they create a greater problem because what happens is a depressed man, young man meets a depressed young lady, and then they have a depressed relationship and produce depressed children, and then the cycle begins. So one of those things that we really have to work on, and I'm thankful to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan because he talked about working. He talked about dealing with the nine ministries. You know, we have so many talents in our community that, you know, that are not really realized because we don't have enough venues to really work them out. But I believe if we work those nine ministries, if we work in the community to find those talents, then we can begin to put that light in our people. And so I think as we begin to talk about these issues, and I know that, you know, we're talking about legal issues, but in that legal issue is a point of depression.
That's heavy. That's heavy, heavy, heavy. So the main crux of what you see a depressed black man and a depressed black woman. And you're saying that comes from what, a socialization? You're saying that's the miseducation? What's driving that depression?
I think that depression is just lack of being able to fulfill their potential. You know, a lot of our young brothers and sisters have big dreams and big goals, you know, because we've been, you know, we don't see TV shows talking about the lifestyle of the mediocre and the average. We see lifestyles of the rich and the famous. We see, you know, we see the cribs. We see all of this, and our young people really want to attain that. But then when they look at what they have sometimes, when they look at their predicament, they don't see their potential looking at their circumstance. So when we can't see our potential because we're trying to look through our circumstance, then it causes for a point of doubt. It causes for a point of saying, well, maybe I can't do it. And then when that happens, then we begin to find those that are unlike mine. And so then we aspire to absolutely do nothing. You know, most of the sentences that on a misdemeanor level, believe it or not, are sentences that will enhance the person. We ask the brother, say, brother, what we want you to do is we want you to keep a job. We want you to finish school. And we don't want you to commit any more crimes. And you have brothers say, oh, no, man, I don't think I can do that. And you go, wow. You know, where are we? You know, why can't you do that? Well, I don't have this. I don't have that. And what we also see is there are some legal traps that are also set for our brothers and sisters. In Alabama, if you drop out of high school at 19, they suspend your driver's license.
Oh.
So now if you're 19 or 20 years old and you dropped out of high school and the police stop you one time and you are suspended on an enrollment violation, until you get your GED, every time they stop you, that's going to be a $400 or $500 ticket.
Mm.
Now, just think, you know, you just think you're going to work. You're a working person. At least you got a job. You're trying to do what you got to do. And all of a sudden, you're looking at a municipal court fine of $2,000 or $3,000, and you're making $8,000 an hour. You're paying, you know, your check is $300 a month, and when you really look at it, and when you're driving through these different municipalities, you might get stopped in one and stopped in two and stopped in three. If you look at your check, and you're paying $200 and $300 a month in fines. So then some brothers ask themselves, well, why am I working? I'm working to pay my fine. I'm not making enough as is to be comfortable, and now I got to pay a punitive cost just to keep and stay on the street.
Yes, sir. Psychological warfare.
Isn't it?
Man.
That's deep. Brother, I'm going to point out something of what you just spoke on. It sounds like the corollary between the original breeding, beating in, and torturing of the black man and woman, the original scary house Negro, is what we mm-hmm. see today. It is a inferiority complex. And generationally in my age, we would say it is the hater. The hater is the fearful Negro, the fear mm-hmm. of failure, because we are used to being perceived as such. We therefore no longer try and accept the mediocrity that we can hold whatever pseudo elements of power we may maintain. That's why you see in the ghettos, we have cars that are worth $600 on $20,000 rims. We see
right.
people spending more economics to maintain a psychological appearance of
right.
happiness, or just comfortability or social legitimization through material items and capitalist dwelt. Like, we throw our resources away on capitalist tokens when we need to be bringing back our cultural wealth. And I thank you, brother, for pointing that out from your insight, for by you being behind the enemy lines and being where you are now and having the ideology of the Honorable Minister Elijah Muhammad. It's a blessing to have your particular viewpoint and analysis here on Black Power Radio, brother.
Praise you to Allah. Praise you to Allah. Sister, it is somewhat, sometimes it's overwhelming because you love your people so much that you don't want to be soft on them because they'll never learn, but at the same time, you know the circumstance, nobody's going to cut them a break. You know, I've had, over the last couple of weeks, I've had a rash of children stealing. You know, and in Alabama and other states, especially southern states, they still have on the books what they call crimes of moral turpitude. Crimes against moral turpitude, and these were crimes that these crimes of moral turpitudes are crimes of basic, you know, I would say, as they call them in nowadays in criminal justice, vice crimes, where you have a crime that a person just, you know, has a bad habit, you know,
right.
stealing, you know, prostitution, drinking out, drinking in public, getting drunk in public, you know, just different things like that. I mean, you know how we do it. You know, we
exactly.
have a good time Friday night. We got those red cups out, those blue cups. We're doing our thing. And then you sell us the cups, and you even sell us the alcohol. And as soon as we partake a little bit too much, then you put us in jail.
Right.
You know, so it becomes a difficulty factor there. But inside of all of that, those crimes against moral turpitude hurt our children, because now they have to put it on their applications. Our children are trying to go to college or trying to go to a community college or a trade school, and they have to put those type of convictions, they have to put those type of arrests on their applications. And if you got a person who's making a decision about a job, and you're saying, this person has a crime against moral turpitude, then you're more than likely going to be eliminated from that prospect. So, you know, it does become a psychological warfare situation where you're trying to do good and you're just sucked out of the game.
Yes, sir. It is what our dear, beloved Comrade General and Field Marshal of the Old Guard Black Panther Party, Brother George Jackson, broke down to us and butted my eye at, the oppressive contract. And a lot of times we don't have a balanced ideological analysis or understanding of the connection between the social institutions built to engender into us predetermined positions that will either perpetuate monopoly capital and fascism or will perpetuate the oppressive nature of the classless. So prisons have always been upheld as that middle ground, the place that you end up if you either fail to receive the favors of the master or you fall victim to the criminalization of the oppressive black contractor. So let me ask you a question, brother, because mm-hmm. by you being based in Alabama, do you feel as though the particular unique legalized enslavement of blacks, not just in America, but especially in the South, because it is a proven fact that the South has been steadfast in holding a covert independence and loyalty to their Confederate racism. And the only way they've been able to enforce that is through the 13th Amendment and the legalized criminalization of black men, especially in black women. So what are your experiences in dealing with criminalization and the loss of black encouragement to be successful, brother, speaking on that depression you spoke to earlier?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things, sister, I have to say, and I would like to bring a point of clarity, I don't believe that the program is very covert. I think it is obviously overt that we are making up a major portion of the incarcerated, so much so that our prison system right now is right at about 285% capacity, so much so that in Alabama is one of the only states in the United States that house prisoners outside of the location of their conviction. Alabama was housing prisoners in Mississippi, Louisiana, as well as Montana. And they were going to private prisons. See, the privatization of prisons, whenever you can fill your hotel up to the rim, then you're going to do that. What you're going to do also is you're going to take young men who are at the peak. If you notice, look at our incarceration ages. Our young men are getting incarcerated at a rate, a very high rate, an astronomical rate, between the ages of 17 and 35. That's the prime of a man's life, at least the foundational aspect of his life. You know, so from 35 and then they come back so disenfranchised. I had a cousin of mine who came back from prison, and he had been in prison for 8 years. And after when he got out, I told him I was going to take him and get a suit. Hey, bro, we're going to go to the mall. We're going to go to a store, and I got a partner working there. We're going to get you a suit, man. We're going to have you looking good and everything. Then we're going to go to dinner. And when he got ready to be fitted for the suit, he just dropped his pants right there in the store. Didn't go in the dressing room. Didn't go. He didn't try to conceal himself or anything. He just took his clothes all right where he was. And my man was kind of like, you know, Brother Muhammad, get your cuz, you know. And I said, well, brother, you know, he'd been disenfranchised. So I had to tell him, I said, brother, go in the dressing room. You know, you have brothers. I took a young brother one day. He had been out of prison probably about 3 days. I had taken him out to eat, get him something, some nice meal and everything. I stopped by the ATM and to get some cash to pay for the meal. And when I got back, the brother was in the back seat. I said, brother, what you doing in the back seat? He said, well, man, I saw you take that money out that building. There wasn't nobody around. He had no concept of an ATM. Mm. You know, so when you are living in a technologically Damn. Driven world like this, and then you begin to bring young men and then expect them to compete at the same level as everyone else without some type of intervention, without some type of we don't really need a halfway house. We need a whole house so that when they come out, they are properly orientated back into what we call the free world. Or what right. we call, you know, society as a whole. So when mm-hmm. we're dealing with this, right. and back to the crux of your question, yes, slavery is by another name in Alabama. There's a book called Slavery by Another Name. It is definitely right. real. You know, it is definitely real when a young man in the state of Alabama can acquire a master specialist welder's degree. Not just a certification, but a master service welder degree, and he is a base welder. And a base welder is a person who can go underwater and weld the basins of bridges. And this brother is contracted to do this, but he can't take his certification once he's released.
Yes, sir.
Because he gained this certification. He gained this certification as a ward of the state. So he can't take what he can't even be certified once he gets out of prison to continue to make a livelihood for himself. But you can put an annex on the Capitol building with precise measurements and have precise architecture and even follow and make blueprints by hand. But you can't turn around and certify yourself as a draftsman. See, that's wrong.
Which is directly opposed to what they say. They incarcerate you because apparently you need to be rehabilitated and reorientated to a productive member of society, yet you are not allowed to be repaired. That's one of the things that I love that my dear brother and comrade, Brother Reginald Muhammad here in Atlanta, speaks on so eloquently on reparations, but the restoration to good conditions of the black man and woman here in America. And the black man will not be allowed to be restored if he is caged and stifled as the deer is stifled in the cage and then expected to run at the natural pace as other deer. No, he's malnutrition. He has no concept of how to use his muscles or how to act instinctively. Brother, I have another question for you in correlation to prisoner consciousness, because we all understand as revolutionaries and black scholars and thinkers and intellectuals that oppression breeds resistance. And we as revolutionaries have a divine responsibility to continue the struggle no matter where we may be. Now, within prisons, that is one of the most revolutionary potent places that we have potential warriors. We've seen that historically. There is a group right now in Alabama, in St. Clair's County, I believe, called the Free Alabama Movement, who did a strike today. And they are doing a nonviolent protest, but we all agree that any level of resistance that can cripple economically the institutions that perpetuate fascism and monopolize capital in America, then they are tactics that must be executed. We will exist all tactics until we are free.
Right.
Do you have any more information on them? Because we're just now really learning of their efforts, and I also want to know your opinion on how it has affected the prisoners' consciousness or the overall political climate within the prisons and the reaction of the state of Alabama to this prison collective action against prison labor and enslavement?
Well, I think I'm praying for our dear brothers who are participating, and I believe their sentiments and their actions have taken an effect, because if nothing else, we're talking about it right now, and we're talking about the state of Alabama. And if enough people talk about the state of Alabama, then people won't come here for tourist reasons. People won't go to the Alabama games for whatever their reasons may be, because of the fascism and the ill treatment of the prisoners. So I think they are doing it. They are doing a mighty work. And I don't have a whole lot of background on that particular situation, but what I will do, I will begin to, because I know a few of the people and wardens and everyone down at St. Clair, and what they need to do is begin to get on a letter-writing campaign where they write those people who are in positions. I will write every municipal court judge in the state of Alabama to give them their platform, and just have a letter of a consensus letter, just one letter that they could send out all to state their platform so that people can really understand their collective voice. Oftentimes, they don't, the mass media and the mainstream media here in Alabama has bleeped it, but not necessarily covered it. You know, so they don't necessarily want the mass public to know what the real issue is. And I'm so happy that we do have situations where we have communications that are other than those that are mainstream, that we can get information out and disseminate information all over the country. And we need to ask and call and write the different representatives, go to the Alabama government's, state of Alabama's website, and see who the chairperson for the prison reform and prison prison committee is, write that man and tell him, oh, that woman, and write him and ask him for an explanation. Ask him what's going on and see if he knows. See, Alabama's prisons have been in turmoil for a little while because they are so overpopulated. And the reason that they're overpopulated is because there are six times as many young black men in prison than there are on the college campuses at the HBCUs in Alabama. So when we're looking at that, then we have to look and ask the question, what is your motive? You know, is your motive to educate our young men or incarcerate our young men? All of these young men are not criminals. I don't believe that we have that type of criminal element in our community, but what we do have a lot of young men because of or for some reason have made bad judgments and made bad made actions that came from bad decision-making. So I believe, as you asked earlier, one of the ways that we can remedy this problem is that our professionals, those who have acquired learning, those who have acquired degrees and are in professional points, roll up their sleeves and begin to mentor these young men that are in middle school and mentor these young men and women that are in grade school so that they can begin to teach them how to make decisions. When you're 9 years old and you're the head of the household, what kind of decision are you going to make? You're going to make a decision to survive. And that may be knocking somebody in the head, that may be going in somebody's window, but you're trying to survive. You're not looking at the bells and whistles. You're looking at the necessity of things. So when we're looking at that, we have a duty as those who are educated. We have a duty of those who are in positions. That education and those positions, they expire at a particular point in time. I mean, that means we get off of our particular task. We don't work 24 hours a day. But in that time that we have off, we got to be able to roll our sleeves up and go back into the communities in which from which we came. Some of us, all of us, didn't come from the silk and the mansions. A lot of us did come from the projects. A lot of us did come from shotgun houses and dirt floors. See, we still have red dirt in Alabama. We still have dirt floors in Alabama. So a lot of us came from that. A lot of us came from water and cornbread as dinner.
Indeed.
You know what I'm saying? So a lot of us, you know, a lot of us, we still have first-generation college students in our community who don't know anything about registration, who don't know anything about college prep and all of this. So we got to mentor our young people. We have to mentor these young people so that they won't or place them in a position to make better decisions. So, you know, with our legal backgrounds and our medical backgrounds and all of this, it should give us a concern that we got to step up.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That's
I'm
real
in total
talk. That's real talk.
I have one more question for you, and I'm going to allow our National Chief of Staff to take back over. I just want to get a brother asked me a question about private ownership of prisons as a tactic. Since private citizens own them and have some form of control, the prison administration is over the curriculum and activities of the prisoners. So if a person who owns the prison privately, do they have any control over the administrative activities or curriculum provided to the inmates, sir?
Are you asking does the prison owner have it or does the state have the control?
Exactly. The person who owns the actual prison itself, do they have any board or executive power on that prison administration to provide activities and curriculum to the inmates?
It all depends on their contract, because I have seen it both ways. I have seen private prisons who come in with their own administration, and then the state pays them a price, pays them a wage, or pays them a contracted amount to run that prison. And so they hire their own managers, they hire their own shift commanders, they hire their own foremen, and so the only thing they have to do is they have a slight curriculum that all of them will qualify for or qualify with in order to qualify to fill that particular contract. You know, you're not going to have a situation that you're on one tangent and the state is on the other, but the state is going to move with your tangent anyway. because it's a private prison. The only thing we're trying to do is incarcerate you, and we'll do it at their cost. Because, see, oftentimes when you begin to talk about private prisons, what you're talking about is concentrated labor camps.
Right.
You're not talking about incarceration and rehabilitation. You're saying we need some bodies to do some work. Now, we'll give you some basic skills to maintain our work. And where it becomes a problem is I'm paying a man in a factory with a family $22 an hour, and where I'm paying 26 prisoners that same $26 or $27 in a week. So look at my bottom line.
Love capital.
And it becomes it's a capitalist venture. And that's what when you begin to read your 10K at your prison reform situation, or your in your stated prison address, you're reading the 10K. You're reading your annual statement or your annual report. Then that's not incarceration. That's business.
Yes, sir.
But then
yes,
when
sir.
You also look at
my brother.
We didn't want to cut you off, Brother Muhammad. Go right ahead.
No, I was about to say when you begin to look at the investors of those private prisons, we probably got some on right now. If we got some Levi's, we probably got some on right now. When we click our lights with General Electric, we probably got some on right now. When we're looking at some portions of Nike, you know, so you have all of these people and all of these industries who are trying to cut their bottom line. And they don't mind investing in a situation where if I can get 100 18-year-olds to work at the price where I could get two employees in my plant, that's a big difference. That's a huge difference.
Yes, sir. The number to call here is 646-478-4447, 646-478-4447. We're talking about black robes, white justice. And I have to say, Honorable Magistrate, I have to say here that you remind me of the late, great Bruce Wright, who put that book down, Black Robes, White Justice. He also had another work. A lot of people don't know about that. The other work he did called Black Justice is a white word. But I want to talk about that in a serious way, because It was his position, talking about Judge Bruce Wright. It was his position that the judicial system was fundamentally unfair towards blacks. That was his first position. That, you know, based upon the numerous cases that he had saw, there was deep seated societal prejudices of white judges, and then he saw a lack of black judges. Do you see the same thing here in 2014? Since the time he wrote that back then?
Well, there is an upswing, but your judges are based in most cases, your judges are elected. And in most cases, when you have a metropolitan area, let's say a Chicago, or let's say a St. Louis, and they're in a particular county, the city of St. Louis may have 90% of the black vote, but the county is made up of maybe 65% more of the vote of the overall county. So can a black candidate win on a countywide election? Even though we have a city where we're 2 million, but if there are 6 million voters, can those 2 million beat the 6 million?
Oh,
and
sir.
So what happens, a lot of our areas are that's some of the problem with a lot of our areas. So and that's so key. That's why, brothers and sisters, I would love for you to, and you just introduced me to Brother Bruce Wright, and I want you to know a man by an attorney by the name of Orzel Billingsley. Orzel Billingsley, Arthur Shores, and Fred Gray were the civil rights attorneys in the Alabama area. Orzel Billingsley what he did, he would go out and write the charters and write the city charters for these different communities that made them cities and towns in the state of Alabama. So right now in the state of Alabama, Alabama has 59 black mayors.
Mm.
Now, what he did with that, when he made those municipalities, in order to get a congressional seat, you have to have X amount of municipalities within a voting range. He organized those different hamlets and those different towns into cities and towns rather than just communities, and then they began to have enough number representation that they could qualify themselves for a congressional district. So what you did is you went in and created representation for yourself that you control.
That's deep, brother. Can you repeat that?
Yes, ma'am. I said his name is Orzel Billingsley, Attorney Orzel Billingsley. And Brother Billingsley drafted the charters for several, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was 29 cities in the state of Alabama that were hamlets or communities, and organized them into towns and communities. And in order to create a congressional district, you had to have X amount of cities in your district in order to become a district. So now what we see now as the 7th congressional district of the state of Alabama, and if I'm not mistaken, the Honorable Terry Sewell is the representative now, but it was Earl Hilliard and Arthur Davis in the inception of it, and they represented in Congress. And these are she's a congressperson now. She's the congresswoman for our area. This is how we get things done. We have to go in with the letter of the law. Because they say that the lady is blind, you know, she must have a very sheer blindfold sometimes. But she should be blind, and the letters of the law should determine the depth of the law. So if it's good for you, when they say we are created equal, that may be a little farcy. I think we are created equally, but not necessarily equal. But
right.
When we are dealing with this law piece, what we have to do is understand what we are dealing with. And so, if we know the rule, then we can play the game. Or if we know that we're not in a game. If we know that we're not in a game. And see, the more that we play with it, and we are, and they're teaching now our black lawyers to go out and drove themselves in debt. So now they're chasing ambulances and making crooked deals just so they can get to the next client. But we've got to get to a point where we're doing legal research that can unbind some of the things that we're caught up in on a daily basis.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Shout out to my lawyers for justice.
Yes. Just like our dear brothers, Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall and Fred Gray, and a brother who was a contemporary and still living, very strong, legal mind in the state of Alabama, Brother Ronald Jackson. I mean, these are the type of people that we have to begin to reproduce, because a few of them are gone and some of them are up in age. So what happens when that mentality leaves? What happens when Allah calls that mentality back to him? Where are we? What have we produced? Yeah, we got a Benz, but what else? We got lawyers now with custom-made suits, but now what else? Do we have any structure in our legal community?
Hell of a question. And that's serious. That's serious. I wanted to get your thoughts on. We're gonna take a couple calls here. We've got callers waiting, but I wanted to get you real quick your thoughts on this latest thing with Jordan Davis and Michael Dunn. I know you watched that like the rest of us. And what are your thoughts in terms of this? The stand your ground and what seems to be now this execution key to execute young black males in the street. What are your thoughts on Jordan Davis, Michael Dunn, stand your ground, Zimmerman, Trayvon? Right ahead, sir.
Well, stand your ground in Alabama, has been sensationalized in the sense of its legality. Standing your ground is simply a defense, not necessarily a law. Standing your ground doctrine stemmed from an old English saying called the castle rule. And the first case in Alabama for what we know now, stand your ground, was tried in 1921. So it's nothing new. It's just been sensationalized from the standpoint that stand your ground simply means that a man's home is his castle. Now, what those men did to those young men, that was not stand your ground. That was murder.
Teach.
You know, very, very overt. That was a crime. That was a criminal. That was a crime scene. That was not a defensive scene. You know, but one of the things I must say, and since I have a nationalist audience, we have to place a greater value on our lives. You know, there are homicides in our community that occur every day. And when those homicides occur in our community, we don't go to the streets like we do when white folks kill us. So it's okay for us to kill us, but when white folks kill us, we draw the line. We have to stand up on that. We have to begin to become as mad when we kill one another, because those are two, three mothers, those are two women, four women now that's in serious mental and physical pain, because two women have lost their husbands, two women have lost their son, two children have lost their fathers, if they weren't then fathers to be. So we don't know what greatness these young men and women have in our community, and especially when we begin to kill our black woman in the communities the way that we are killing black women. You know, we have to really check ourselves as a community. We're going to have to say, hey, we're going to have to stand some ground in our community. The brothers are going to have to get together and go through the community and call some order, not with white folks, with black folks. And when we can call that type of order and say, hey, we're going to work this thing out and this is what it's going to be, we got to be resolute and stern enough and effective enough to have that type of call. But we can't come out there quickly. We can't come out there tights and we trying to get some justice with some skinny jeans on. We can't do that. We can't do that with blonde hair and being men. We got to be real. We got to be for real. We got to keep it more than 100. We got to be up in the 1,000 range because we got to be fired up enough that energy goes into another young man. We can't come out there half-stepping.
Right.
Mr. Farrakhan said we can't come out there stepping tight. We got to come out there men and do what we have to do. And be willing and be willing, brothers and sisters, to love our people into submission. You ain't got to beat them. Just love them. Be out there and hug that little brother with the gun in his pocket. That's why he got the gun, because he wants some love. And if he don't get the love, he'll force the love. So let's love our young brothers back into submission so we can get our community together.
That's right. Let's take some calls here. First call, your area code is 702-406. Again, that's 702-406. You're on live with Black Power Radio. Honorable Chief Magistrate Maurice Muhammad, we're talking about black robes, white justice. Your thoughts, your comments. Welcome, Black Power. Welcome, Black Power. 702-406, last chance. Your microphone's open. Okay. Area code 314-650. You're on live with Black Power Radio. Honorable Chief Magistrate Maurice Muhammad, Black Robes, White Justice. Come on in, conversation, your thoughts, your questions. Welcome, Black Power.
Black Power.
Black Power. How are you? Go right ahead.
Didn't like a slogan.
All right.
Okay, you got a question? Okay.
I think we lost him, Conrad.
Okay, keep moving in. Area code 678-670. 678-670. You're on live, Black Power Radio. Honorable Chief Magistrate Maurice Muhammad, Black Robes, White Justice. We're trying to get some answers to your questions, your comments. Please welcome in Black Power.
Black Power, assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Walaikum salam.
Brother Muhammad, I got a question for you. What is the most revolutionary thing a lawyer or a judge can do, and can that lead to a state assess to a, like a step into separation? Because I heard you talking about the correctional districts. Can that lead to a point of almost a complete separation to an extent?
Well, I would say this, brother. In a certain instance, and I don't mean to sound or be facetious, but the correctional and penal system is almost separated right now because there's such a small percentage of white prisoners until it is really just a system of our own. Now, one of the things that I see is we have to begin to have more groups that are powerful and resourceful to go in and to establish interventions with the brothers who are on the inside so that as they begin to come out, we begin to set up a systematic point of re-enfranchising. A revolutionary, and if you would, please kind of help me on the definition of revolutionary. You said revolutionary, what could a revolutionary lawyer do? Could you explain that a little bit for me, brother?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what I mean by revolution, I mean something that can really alter the state of the black community. I know we have it populated in the prisons, and they even propagate it on the TV shows. I don't know you heard about the lockdown and all that.
Yes,
they
sir.
Even propagate it on the TV, and it's heavily propagated. But what I mean by revolution now is I'm talking about something that can end up affecting us to a point of a step in progress, and I heard you talking about the halfway houses. That's one of the biggest things we can do. That's one of the biggest things we can do is set up a halfway house or what you call a whole house.
A whole house. That's what we can do, brother, and that's something that in our community, as we see a lot of blighted buildings, we see a lot of places that won't necessarily appeal to the eye. When white people look at desolate places, they see potential. When we look at it, we see work. I think one of the things that we can do, there are a lot of organizations. If we begin to come together, a revolutionary thought today is black unity and us being able to come together around an issue and say we're going to come together regardless of our walks of life, regardless to our ideologies, and regardless to our station and place and being, and come together and work for the betterment of our community. So what I'm saying to you, if we begin to see apartment buildings and we begin to see places that people are abandoning, then this is an opportunity to have a re-entry point. If we can begin to have very stern and very organized reentry points for our young men, then the recidivism will begin to decrease. The Unity House, I was a co-founder and a board member of a process called the Unity House. And the Unity House was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And what we did with the Unity House, brother, is we found a brother who had a couple of abandoned houses, and they were abandoned. And so we came to him and said, look, brother, if we can rally the community to come in and renovate these homes, can we have houses for a year? He said, I'll do better than that. You can have homes as long as you need them. And so what we did is we went in, a couple of Christian organizations, Muslim Mosque, Nation of Islam, the Masjid, a couple of us got together and said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have a Unity House. And it was slated and organized for women who were coming out of prison, homeless, because a lot of times when women come out of incarceration and they don't have, or anybody who comes out of incarceration and they don't have any place to go, then they go back to what they know. And one lady that was with us who came to live with us, brother, she was infested with ticks. She was living in the woods. And so we brought her in, cleaned her up, And this young lady actually finished community college in nursing last spring.
Hey, brother, can you? What about the funding?
What we did with the funding, this is how
did you fund it?
This is how we funded it. We asked 50 people for $10 a month for a whole year. $500 a month we paid the light bill, the gas bill, and the cable bill for computer purposes. Everything else was straight donations. We didn't ask anybody for anything, and the reason we did it that way is so that because if we collected a rent from them, everybody stayed free. If we collected rent from them or if anything happened, then we couldn't enforce the rules of our organization. We said there were no men to visit. That would mean, because we ain't sitting up for that. This ain't the spot. You know, this ain't the jump-off spot. This is rehabilitation. And so what we did with that, we said we're going to have 50 people, and we talked to the people, interviewed the people. We made the people endowed with the information and the vision that we had, and people came and gave. They gave us flat-screen televisions. They gave us computers. They gave us beds. They gave us dressers. They gave us box springs. We didn't have to pay for anything.
Is it still going on now?
No, sir. And the reason that is not going on, the brother who gave us the property died last year, and his family had to liquidate the property, so his family had to sell it. But he made his word bond. We kept that house in operation for about 3.5 years. And if you'd like, you can go to the TuscaloosaNews.com and pull up Unity House. And they'll show you an article on the grand opening. We even had a Unity Garden where we asked each one of the churches in the community to plant a row of crops. And then we had a program to celebrate the harvest of those rows of crops right there in the garden. So we had a dinner where we cooked the food and made the pepper. We had peppers and different things like that. So it can be done, brother. It can be done. We just have to organize and be creative enough to do it.
That's what we got to hear. That's what we got to hear. We got to hear that it can be done. And I want to thank you so much. Thank you so much for that call, Carla. Appreciate that. That's what we have to be able to say, Brother Muhammad. We got to be able to say that it can be done. I want to talk about the situation with the felons now. I know a lot of people out there are finding it hard. And what I get a lot, and I know you could probably get this too, is that a lot of people say, it's hard. I can't find work because I got a felony. And they're getting turned away, and they feel like they're forced back into the life of crime or to the streets. I mean, can you talk to the felons and, those who might feel hopeless listening to this broadcast right now?
Well, one of the things, brothers and sisters, that I would like to impart upon the brothers and sisters there in the audience is to know your status. Oftentimes, there are deals that are done in court, and it is beyond the original status of what we started with. So it may have been a first-degree situation when we first started, but we may, and if you took a plea, if you took a deal or something to that effect, know the contents of the deal. Because oftentimes people will be unconvicted of a felony, but arrested for a felony. And they have not gone to see what the dispositional recording was, the final disposition of my case. The attorney's not going to tell you because he's moving on to the next dollar. But it is that person who is convicted of that particular crime. With our brothers who are felons, know your rights. There are some states, Alabama is one, that offers partial pardons for certain crimes. Know your rights. Now, a pardon is not an expungement. There's a distinct difference between the two. A pardon is pretty much a habeas corpus act where they free the body, but not necessarily the paperwork. So you may be out of jail on a pardon in some instances, but the paperwork is still alive and well. So please know your status. Know what your rights are. Know the degree of your crime, because even with assault in the third and assault in the second and assault in the first in Alabama is listed as a violent crime. So most of the conservative right will not lend any ear to violent perpetrators, not on early release, not on any type of diversion programs, not on any type of alternative sentencing, nothing, because they can't have the rap of being, quote-unquote, soft on crime.
That's heavy information. Sister, now you had a question there?
No, actually, he answered my question several paragraphs of value information ago, brother. I was just caught up in thought listening. I actually did have another question concerning the were you just speaking on the Stand Your Ground laws, and you said something about it's been sensationalized by its legitimacy or its legalization. What other laws, bills, or just cases that have been sensationalized or used against us statewide do you think we need to bring awareness to or just maintain the action against? What steps do we need to take to continue to grow consciousness from this whole overall conversation and discussion?
Well, I think one of the things we need to, because there are so many different, and there are so many different ways to deal with this situation, because unfortunately, every state has its own body of law. So what may be very close to what's going on here in Alabama may be totally different in Georgia. It may be totally different in Florida. Here in Alabama, if a young man has a nickel bag of marijuana and it's personal use, it's granted personal use. You can't distribute a nickel bag, but it's personal use, and he's convicted of that. The very next arrest that he gets for personal use is a felony. And if a brother's smoking a nickel bag, he ain't going to just stop. You know, it's not a situation where,
right.
You know, if a brother's smoking a nickel bag, some smoke is probably some fire. So if he's going to get caught again, and at this point in time, he will go to prison for 5 years for a nickel bag of marijuana.
Yes, sir.
You know, so that's what I'm saying. But in some states, a nickel bag on the first arrest is a felony. You may not go to prison, but you may be caught up in some type of superior court where it is a court of recording, and they record your verdict, and then you're penalized for that. You know, but for the most part, know your status. You know your laws. You know your state's law. You know, we're going to have to get into an arm of legal research. We've got to have legal researchers to go out and begin to show even the commonalities in certain laws. There were, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there were 27 states on of Stand Your Ground. You know,
what about the written
and
unwritten laws? How do those affect us? The written and unwritten laws, and these are more so active in the South. We fall victim to the unwritten laws. There are a lot of laws that are on the state books that we don't know about, but we will be charged for them and convicted.
Yeah.
What would you suggest that we go about not just finding out through the freedom of information, but how we can, in an organized fashion, get this information to the masses and prior planning prevent poor performance?
Well, I think one of the things we need to do, as I said earlier, we need to invoke some type of research group. You know, I think every organization needs a legal research team or legal research group. The New Black Panthers need a legal research group, because when you go into an area, you may go into a county or a state that says, well, you can do X, Y, and Z, but over in this place, 2 miles away in a different county, you may not be able to do that. Like, for instance, in Alabama, we have what we call our dry city, a dry county, where you cannot sell alcohol or beer in the county, but you can ride 2 minutes over into another county and buy as much beer as you want. Now, just think about if you're over in this county and you don't know that this is a dry county and you're drinking beer after 2 o'clock in that county and the police arrest you. You know, so those are certain issues. You know, know what the rules are. You know, we're going to have groups that concentrate on the rules. These are the rules.
Right.
These are the new laws. Because here in Alabama, they just removed within our adulthood, they just removed the illegal participation laws in the state of Alabama. See, the illegal participation or unlawful participation is what they would charge blacks and whites with for playing together. If I was over at a little white boy's house and we were outside playing catch, the police could stop and write me a citation for illegal participation.
Man.
Yes, sir. It's a proven fact here in the state of Georgia. It is legal to beat your wife on the Capitol steps on Sunday. No other day. This is on the state of Georgia's books. It's been on the books since the late 1900s. But, yes, sir. These are the types of ridiculous laws that we're subject to live under.
In my time as a magistrate, I was a party of a magistrate issuing a warrant for adultery. Now, how busy now?
Man.
Looking in our community, how busy do you think we'll be at that point if we start enforcing stuff like that? You know,
you wouldn't get no sleep, would we?
You know, it was 2004. And they were still announcing the fact that that Alabama was about to have a referendum to pass a law to make legal interracial marriages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was illegal. It was on the books that you couldn't marry outside of your race. So we're not talking 50 years ago. We're not talking civil rights era. We're talking iPhone era, where we're still dealing with this type of madness.
Yes, sir. The state of Mississippi outlawed legal lynching in 2008 officially.
Mm-hmm. Officially.
Officially.
Officially. Outlaw was repealed, just like the decision to release those sisters. Do you remember when they had the sisters that I think they stole like $1.85 worth of stuff and they put them in prison for a few years and the governor pardoned them for the crime and then they went into special session and reversed the governor's pardon and brought the women back, tried to bring the women back to jail.
Wow.
See when you're dealing with a mind like that, you have to have, and that's why. And may Allah be pleased with our dear brother Chokwe Lumumba. That's why he was on in their side, because he wouldn't let them get away with anything like that. He wouldn't let them budge on that. He was all in their faces. You know, I was about to say in their grill. He was all in their faces when injustices like that happened, because
he was
a real brother. You know, he was about what he was about. You know. And we have to now produce that same fire in our generation. It's our time.
Yes,
absolutely.
Sir.
When you look at the history, Honorable Chief, when you look at the history of like say COINTELPRO and the cases of Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, you look at Mumia Abu Jamal, or you look at any of the countless other victims of that counterintelligence program, or the Move 9, or any of them freedom fighters, from a legal standpoint, what kind of ammunition do we have that could free our political prisoners? Because as it stands now, I don't think that even to this day, the U.S. has acknowledged that it has political prisoners. From a legal standpoint, is there anything legally that you know of that could help those who are on the front lines to free our political prisoners?
One of the things we have to begin to fund their legal research, because I had an opportunity to meet a brother. Brother Ray at that time was about 72. Brother Ray had the record. He did 43 years in federal prison. He went to prison the week before they made Social Security numbers legal or mandatory. So when he was born, he didn't have a Social Security number. But Brother Ray began to teach himself legal research at an early age while he was in prison. He was one of the only brothers who could read in the federal prison. And he began to study and study and write and write and study and write. And he ended up having, if I'm not mistaken, he told me he had 12 to 14 decisions from the Supreme Court reversed based on his legal research. He was a bad brother. Matter of fact, he was incarcerated in Kansas, in Missouri, and the University of Missouri's law school would bring him in as a guest lecturer to teach legal research and writing. It is all in the legal research. It is all in the ability to write and make those summary judgments so crisp that you argued your point and made the point overlap the racism. And once we began to get really into the point of legal research and writing, I believe we will be able to free not only our political prisoners, we will be even begin to be, to free our congressional prisoners.
Okay.
And congressional prisoners, I mean those men and women who are making laws that they know will be detrimental in our community, but since they are being supported by special interests, those special interests are fueling them. We'll be able to write laws for them and write our own laws in our own community. And the way that we do that is get involved in our law-making process at its very basic state. That's in our communities.
Brother, how effective is lobbying in this strategy that you're breaking down right now?
It is very effective, but lobbying is commercial from the standpoint of you have a special interest. You have people that you're paying to talk and paying to sway and paying to woo, but issues have to be dealt with in the by educating the public. Because what happens is you get enough calls as a representative, it doesn't matter how much you donate to my campaign. If my voters are dissatisfied, then I got a problem. Because
yes, sir.
I'm actually getting the money to persuade my voters. You know, people, the politicians pay for face recognition or name recognition and facial recognition, and that's why they need the money so they can get on television. They can put a banner out and put a sign in your yard and put a sign in this yard. But if you're not educating the voter and we're simply giving them a sample ballot, I think in 2014 a sample ballot is worse than Jim Crow law, because now you've taken the reasoning and you're taking the person's intelligence and you're playing with it. And if I have $3,000, $5,000 and I can get on your ballot, I might not have your people in your best interest, but I got a pocket full of money, and now I'm on your ballot.
Carrot and the stick.
Happy.
Before your analysis, brother.
Absolutely. The situation now, we're throwing a lot at you, Honorable Chief, but I know you can handle it because this is your field. The situation right now that's happening in our community with this police brutality, you have to address this. And the misconduct, because as it seems to most people that I talk to, it seems like now that the police forces in the state have green light to execute black men and women in the streets, and that as soon as they come before the courts, they'll be given a thumbs up for justifiable homicide. As a chief magistrate, you know, concerned about the people, what are some steps that you would suggest that we do, you know, to defend ourselves, and you know, in the best way we can?
Well, one of the things, brother, I really believe that we must equip our citizens and our brothers and sisters in the community with as much knowledge of the laws as possible. I remember a few years ago when I was magistrate in Birmingham, we had a heavy flux of criminal trespassing in the project. And I'm like, why are we getting 15 to 20 arrests in a day out of these housing projects? I mean, what's going on? And it bothered me to a point where I left the job and went to the projects to see for myself what was happening. So I loaded up the car, me and a couple of brothers, and we walked the projects. We talked to the people. We talked to the people and the police. What's the problem? What's going on that we are that these young men and women are being arrested at a number and at this rate? And what we found out, it was a two-pronged situation. The young people in the community did not know their rights as a community because they were arresting them for simply driving down the street. And we found out, looking at the law, we did the legal research on the trespassing ordinance in the state of Alabama dealing with the housing projects, which is a federal-owned property.
Mm-hmm.
So what we found out in that process is that the streets that the projects are a part of belong to the city. The breezeway and the actual, as they call it, appendage of the apartment is a housing project. So was the young man on the porch? No, he was in the car. So how then can we arrest him for trespassing?
Right.
Right.
So they didn't know the law that they were enforcing. So one of the ways that we get our brothers and sisters out of the harm's way is to begin to really teach them their rights. We ended up, you know, I'm a different kind of spirit, brother. I'm not a money motivated type of brother, so I don't mind doing something for people. And I did it on my own. I did a community of you and the law. And I went in there and got the code book and opened it up and blew it up, put it on a little PowerPoint presentation, and explained to them what the law. And one brother said, man, you mean I can't smoke weed in my house? Is your house in Alabama?
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's illegal to possess marijuana in Alabama. You know, so our people, we have to get accustomed to following rules and regulations, but no one has the right. The police don't have the right to murder and brutalize our people. And one of the first things is in police brutality situations that I would ask for is the mental evaluation in the application process for our police officers. Because a lot of our police officers are former military. They're former combat veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome and have not been treated, and they can fail the mental evaluation but pass the shooting test, and they're hired.
And guess
where you think they put those who fail that mental evaluation?
Black community. Got to
be. Oh, man, yeah, every time.
Those angry COs. Brother, I got one last question for you. I know I have overloaded you, sir. Is there any important legal terms that are used to corral us into the prison system? I know I witnessed a young lady who could have took the option of NOLO or something along that lines that would have relinquished her of the charge, but she took the other one, no contest, which is like, I'm not guilty, but I am, and she took all the charges and had to do probation and pay over $1,200 in court fees or something that was unjustified due to the terminology that she did not understand, sir.
A lot, like I said, a lot of that is jurisdictional. If you have to kind of look and see what is the norm for your area, for your particular jurisdiction, even the state situations, because you have different states that may be republics or they may be states. So we have to, republics pretty much rule, and they go from old common law practices of England. Your states are dealt with constitutional-based pieces of different European countries and other places like that. So so it all depends. So they'll use certain language that may be totally different but may be the same all at the same time. So to say look for, you know, look for null pros or look for dismissal, it's all in the language. If a person null pros is a process, what they're doing is they are stopping the process but not necessarily dismissing the charge. So if a case is null pros per se, say you want to null pros a case, if it is null pros by a police officer, if it's within the statute of limitations, that police officer could come back and re-prosecute the case because he stopped the process. He didn't dismiss the process.
Right. It's just in a state of limbo.
Yeah. Right. And what happens is, if I null pros it, I'm not really bothering it anymore, and I let the statute run out, and then you can't get it anyway. So it's the same thing as though I dismissed it, I just didn't process it.
But even that,
you can dismiss it without prejudice. And when you dismiss it without prejudice, you can come back and dismiss it, but you can start the process all over again. And then prosecute.
I like Troy Davis.
Oh, of course.
I give thanks to you, brother. I really do. It was an honor and a blessing to be with you here tonight. You shed light on several issues and added to my overall analysis, sir. I give thanks. Assalamu alaikum, Black Power.
Black Power.
Certainly. And like I say, brothers and sisters, we're being treated right here. We have a few minutes left in the show here, but I want to just ask you to talk about Operation Clean Slate. If you could talk about that and you know what that was about, and if that's still rolling, you know, what does that mean? Operation Clean Slate.
Well, Operation Clean Slate was basically an amnesty program where we gave the citizens of our area, and we had warrants on. We had 4,000 warrants in our city. That were just outstanding, sitting on the shelf. And we said, well, why don't we give people an opportunity to come in and without penalty, without fear of arrest, let them take care of their business. If you owe $500 and you got $500, and rather than going to jail and go through all of that process, we would dismiss your warrant if you would just simply pay your fine. And we were doing that because people were saying, well, I would get my driver's license, but I got an issue in Bessemer. I have an issue dealing with with a ticket. I didn't finish paying on my ticket. And it would be issues like, well, how much do you owe? And I remember one young lady owed $19.50. And she's had a license suspended for 3 years based on $19.50.
Economic slavery.
You know, and so with that, she couldn't get a job because she couldn't get an ID, because if she had gone to the identification location at our state, they would have arrested her for the warrant that we have outstanding for. And she didn't have the money to post bond. So her whole life is on hold for $20. You know, so
crazy.
We saw that over and over again, and there was an element of the community that was like, man, that's a trick. They're going to get you down there and put you in jail and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But what befuddled me was the white community took advantage of it 100%. I mean, they were in. I had one, this little white lady, she came in there in a elevated hospital wheelchair. It was basically like a hospital bed made like a wheelchair. But she had oxygen and everything else. And we were like, yeah, I mean, we brought her in and took care of business. and she moved on. And she got her license, and now she was able to qualify. She told me, she wrote me a little letter and told me now she was able to qualify for all of her handicap benefits. There were certain benefits she couldn't qualify for with that warrant outstanding. So, you know, what we did with Clean Slate, we allowed the people to come in and take care of their business with us without the penalty, and that was basically a forerunner to the expungement piece that was just signed in Alabama April 1st. And basically that was the expungement piece was a bill that was sponsored by our brother Charles Rangel
mm-hmm.
from New York
mm-hmm.
Back in 2007. And he sponsored a bill called the Second Chance Act. President Bush jumped on the Second Chance Act because Martha Stewart was in jail, and if she was in jail, a 503C organization that's receiving funding from the federal government could not be headed by a person with a felony conviction up until that point. You know, so her whole organization would have been in shambles. And just like Scooter Libby and all of them, they took advantage of the Second Chance Act of 2007 to come in and begin to expunge their records and begin to deal with their civil liberties as a formerly incarcerated person. So they would make an act and go past it, and you didn't hear nobody. You hadn't even heard about it. I hadn't even heard about it since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking to one judge, and I was asking him about it, and he said he thought it had been repealed.
Mm.
But it was a very strong act, but it was an act that is taken advantage of other people when it's to their advantage. So
yes,
what
sir.
We have to do is set the advantage. And our brother Charles Rangel, he had foresight. He saw young brothers trying to come out of prison, and that was one little piece of that act that kind of caught our community off guard, and we weren't ready for it, called the Faith-Based Initiatives. Y'all remember when that was a big craze, Faith-Based
yes,
Initiative,
sir.
And all of a sudden people started getting faith-based money and started misappropriating, and then they started going to jail themselves. You know, it hit real rampant among our mega preachers because they were getting all of these, you know, these big grants and stuff and for computers and this, that, and the other, and there wasn't no computers being found. So they got the money and didn't do what they said they were going to do with the money, and those folks held them accountable. But moreover, when you took the faith-based initiative, you could not endorse a political candidate. So now the very, very organ of the black community, the black church, has to be silent when it came to politics.
Sir.
Yes, sir.
Now, heavy.
You know, so,
heavy,
so
heavy.
All of those issues, man, are coming up, and they'll sneak one in on us, and we go hook, line, and sucker for it, and then the next thing you know, all of our hands are cut. All of our lines are cut, and all of us are placed in a little bait box. And they constantly move at us and try to pick us on the bait box. And then once they get, you know, they had the little TV show called Bait Car. They have bait laws that'll get us trapped in there and we can't get out of it. And then we'll ride and try to run and all that stuff. And they sitting up there laughing at us and watching us.
Right.
Yep.
Entrapment,
yep.
But not. It's all slippery and trickery at the United Snakes of America. We understand.
Yeah, some amnesia.
Sir, certainly what it is. And my final question to you, big brother, for the night is dealing with these drug laws and these
mm-hmm.
drug codes, because I know me and the national chairman was having a discussion the other night, and he just got freed completely off of probation and everything, so we're happy about that. But we were talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting in the court, and he was seeing so many of the young brothers and sisters catching drug cases, and
mm-hmm.
getting big numbers for drug cases. My question is, and I've asked this to several attorneys, I want to ask you too, is that how come that the participants who flooded our communities with the drugs, the crack cocaine and all of that, the stuff that's on record? How come there's been no prosecution from the leading attorneys or whoever that can, you know, bring the conspirators to justice?
Well, my grandfather kind of gave it to me like this, Brother Kwali. He said, a little boy asked his grandfather, he said, "Daddy, why does the lion always die at the end of the story?" And he told him, he said, "Son, the lion is not writing the story." So those drug laws, those mandatory sentencing, and that whole nine yards is one big happy family. And the reason is we are not writing the law. So a young white fella can get 90-day probation for the same possession of powder cocaine, which is a little more potent than crack cocaine. But a crack cocaine dealer starts his mandatory sentencing at 5 years. Now, the difference there is a very strong demographic point that we have to understand and have to know that is relevant. And that demographic point is the fact that young black men are being hunted.
Right.
And when they are being hunted, they use every means to get the prey. When we have mandatory sentencing, that's where I've actually met your former chairman, Brother Malik Zulu Shabazz. We did a seminar at Savior's Day, and that was my subject, mandatory sentencing, and I found out that mandatory sentencing was actually a ploy that was actually single-handedly created to destroy Frank Lucas.
Interesting.
And mandatory sentencing, that was a congressman out of Louisiana who wanted to make a name for himself. He then got with the constituency out of the Northeast, out of Boston, the congressman out of Boston who were mob connected, out of New York who were mob connected, and out of Rhode Island who were mob connected, and they told him, "We will back your bill, but we can't sponsor it. If you sponsor it, we'll give you the big name." They sponsored the bill. And 3 years after the bill was sponsored and signed, he disappeared.
Not surprised
so
there.
So it just kind of gives you a point of reference. You know, the way that we deal with this, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but legal research is going to be a strong key. We have to know what we're doing. We can't get up in the middle of the game and then start reading the rule book. We got to know the rules before we hit the table. We got to know the rules before we hit the court. We got to know the rules before we hit the field. And the first thing we got to know, are there rules? You know, because the black man is created to think rightly, so teaches the most honorable Elijah Muhammad, and we give everybody the benefit of the doubt. But at the same time, we have to know, to ask the question, are there any rules? Sometimes some games don't have rules. You just have to play to protect yourself.
Good teaching. That's real good teaching right there. And we reading all between the lines on that one, Chief. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, we have literally couple of minutes left. You have any closing words you want to say to the radio listening audience? We have been certainly treated tonight and certainly well fed, and I am revolutionarily legally inspired to go forward and study. So, yeah, closing words, closing comments, the radio listening audience, Black Power Radio.
I'm honored to be on your show. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and share with you and learn from you as well. I want to, anyone would like to get in contact with me, I'm on Twitter, Bro Maurice 2 is my Twitter handle. I'm on Facebook, and Maurice Muhammad, and you can reach me at mauricemuhammad@gmail.com. Anytime, I'm always open to share. to talk with our brothers and sisters. I'm very passionate about the law and our people in the law, because I believe that once we have a greater handle of the law, I think we'll do better. My grandmother used to tell me most times that when people know better, they seem to do better. So, dear brother, I'm thankful to the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad for his teaching. I'm thankful for the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan for his leadership and guidance. And I'm honored to be with my brothers and sisters of the New Black Panther Party. And may Allah bless you and continue to grow and continue to prosper in this day.
He certainly continue to bless you and keep you and help you in this mission to raise our people, resurrect and rise our people, and to build a nation of our own. And certainly we thank you for feeding us tonight with this information, and we're gonna act on it. And of course, as you know, I'm telling you now, don't be a stranger. Black Power Radio is your home.
Oh, yes, sir.
The New Black Panther Party is your family. So we appreciate you. And as I say at the beginning, only time we want to really see you behind that bench is revolutionary meetings. and so thank you so much, Chief Magistrate. And we will bid you good night. And assalamu alaikum.
Good night, sir. Wa alaikum salam, and may Allah bless you.
Thank you. Same to you as well. Brothers and sisters, you have been listening to the Honorable Chief Magistrate Maurice Muhammad, who has laid it out for us that we have work to do, homework to do, in terms of getting our legal sword sharpened and our legal shield together. Our legal sword sharpened, our legal shield together, which lets you know that when Minister and Dr. Huey P. Newton was carrying around that law book, and when Minister Malcolm X was talking about being an attorney, and Attorney Malik Zulushabaz was giving you them Know Your Rights seminars and all that, that they on the right path, and we got to be on the right path too. But we got to remember what Honorable Chief said here tonight. He said you got to know the rules before you play the game. And sometimes he said, hell, it ain't even no damn rules. You just got to survive. Sometimes you ain't even got nothing in that rule book, nothing in that law book. Sometimes you just have to survive. But if there's something in there, you got to know the rules, and we want you to know the rules. So we'll be pushing forward on that. We'll be pushing forward more on those cases, more looking into that stand your ground centralization, centralization of the stand your ground law, and the other draconian laws that are on the books. We're going to look into that because they're affecting our people, and gonna arm you with knowledge on how to defend you against the police harassment and brutality and murder of black people. And of course, as the Chief Magistrate said tonight, we gotta be willing to take to the streets and get active and deal in our own homes and communities on black crime and violence. And so certainly we have been fed tonight, and we've done well. And we want you to spread this message around. Take these shows and email these shows around. You got a Twitter, tweet these shows. Of course, you can catch us at New Black Panther 1. Again, that's New Black Panther 1. That's Panther spelled with the P-A-N-T-H-R, the number 1. New Black P-A-N-T-H-R 1 on Twitter. Or catch us on our Facebooks and go to newblackpanther.com and register with the organization that is helping to educate our people and refine our people and redevelop our people to knowledge of self and to build a territory and nation of our own, ultimately to control what the Chief Magistrate here was talking about, which is laws for black people. And so call us if you need to catch us at our headquarters at 347-903-0886. Again, that's 347-903-0886. Drop us a line at New Black Panther Headquarters at gmail.com. And again, the website is newblackpanther.com. We will be with you again next week, right black at you, Monday night. We'll be on with our national chairman, Minister Hashim Nzinga, the general, and so many others. He got some surprise guests coming up. I'm not going to even let the panther out of the bag just yet, but I already put some stuff in my ear. You're going to truly, truly enjoy it, and it's really, really going to blow your mind. We got some surprise guests coming up for you So be sure to tell a neighbor, tell a friend about Black Power Radio. And you all, be wise, be safe, and stay on your toes. Keep a soldier mentality out there. Remember, it's Black Power for Black people. It's power to the people. And remember this, if Black people are not free, there's nobody that's free. Black Power, we signing out.
Freedom is not given. If you depend on the man who puts you in this condition to give you your freedom, then you can never be free indeed. Because if he has the power to give you your freedom with one hand, he has the power to take it back with his other hand or with the same hand.
To God, true. I wake up in the morning.